$500 billion in debt. With the eurozone wobbling, the American money market funds that were pulling out of European bank bonds continued to shift into US treasuries. But appearances were deceptive. Investor demand for US government debt held up, but above all in lower-risk, short maturities. The average maturity of US treasuries held by the MMFs declined from 95 days in January 2010 to only 70 days at the end of July 2011. Meanwhile, financial engineers began to contemplate the need for something no one had contemplated before: credit default swaps against US treasuries. Prior to 2008, the market for US Treasury CDS had not existed. What would have been the point of insuring the risk-free asset class on which the entire global financial system rested? In the wildly improbable event of a US default, the general destabilization would be such that it was unclear whether any private financial entity would still be in a position to act as a reliable counterparty. Who would be left standing to pay out on insurance against the end of the world? Nevertheless, having first come into existence during the turmoil of 2008, when it seemed that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac might fail, in the course of 2011, the niche market for CDS on US treasuries sprang back into life. In the last days of July, just over 1,000 contracts were outstanding, with spreads running to 82 basis points. It was a fraction of what investors in Greek debt paid, but it was astonishing that the market existed at all. On July 31, 2011, Washington pulled back from the abyss. A budget compromise was reached that would impose automatic austerity if the two warring parties could not agree on cuts by the end of the year. Reluctantly, sufficient Tea Party radicals were won over to the Republican leadership's position for the deal to go through. It took heavy lobbying and hours of alarmist lectures by credit rating experts and former officials from the Bush administration to convince the Republican insurgents of the dramatic consequences of a default. But the damage was done. As Mitch McConnell, the Republicans' leader in the Senate, blithely informed the media, "I think some of our members may have thought the default issue was a hostage you might take a chance at shooting. Most of us didn't think that. What we did learn is this. It's a hostage worth ransoming." As Jason Chaffetz, one of the hard-line Tea Party newcomers, remarked, the threat had been real. "We weren't kidding around. We would have taken it down." On August 3rd, China's Dagong Ratings Agency was the first to draw the obvious conclusion. It downgraded the United States from A+ to A. As Dagong remarked, at this crucial juncture, neither the Democratic Party nor Republican Party has shown any consideration for the general interest in order to argue for their own partisan interest. They had a hard time making the correct choice in a timely manner, leaving the world in terror, which highlights the negative role of the U.S. political system on an economic basis. The U.S. political system, the Chinese analysts concluded, cannot resolve the fundamental influence of low economic growth, high deficit, and increasingly higher debt to the debt service capability through increasing real wealth creation, with the declining national solvency irreversible. It is natural that QE3 monetary policy will be enabled for the next step, which will throw the world economy into an overall crisis. The status of the US dollar will be essentially shaken in this process. This was the judgment of the G20 at Seoul, turned into the language of credit rating. The year ended with a big sell-off of US government debt by Beijing. But there was no rout. The long build-up of Chinese claims on the US taxpayer had ended, but the portfolio stabilized at between $1.2 and $1.3 trillion. Criticism from China was only to be expected. More surprising was the fallout at home. On August 5th, the unthinkable happened. One of America's own ratings agencies, Standard & Poor's, downgraded the United States from AAA to AA+. S&P cited the political brinkmanship of recent months and the mounting evidence that America's governance and policymaking was becoming less stable, less effective, and less predictable. It also pointed to the supposedly unsustainable level of U.S. debt and the speed of its accumulation, which would take it well over 90% of GDP by 2021, the notorious Reinhardt and Rogoff threshold. But when the U.S. Treasury was handed the explanation for S&P's decision, it became clear that the ratings agency had committed an elementary mistake. By applying the figures for debt growth to the wrong benchmark scenario, it had wildly overstated the deficit to be expected over the next 10 years. Even more surprisingly, when this error was pointed out, S&P did not retreat. It left the downgrade in place as well as the explanatory text, minus the modelling error. This led the Treasury to fire off an official denunciation. S&P still chose to proceed with their flawed judgment by simply changing their principal rationale for their credit rating decision from an economic one to a political one. The magnitude of this mistake and the haste with which S&P changed its principal rationale for action raise fundamental questions about the credibility and integrity of S&P's ratings action. No one doubted the weakness of the U.S. political system. But S&P had delivered just one more demonstration of how broken the ratings agencies were. It was their AAA certifications, handed out to hundreds of billions of subprime MBS, that had helped to precipitate the crisis in 2008. It was their serial downgrades that were setting the pace of the crisis in the Eurozone. But it turned out that they could not even get their sums right on the U.S. budget. Trillions of dollars of debt were losing their status as safe assets. The U.S. Treasury was accused by the German finance minister of interventionist tendencies akin to communism. NATO was squabbling over Libya. The loose monetary policy of the Federal Reserve was blamed for fomenting revolt in the Middle East. The EU was locked into a self-deceptive non-solution to the Greek debt crisis, and when it was not engaged in extend and pretend, it was openly and unabashedly lying. Both Italy's prime minister and the managing director of the IMF were up on sex charges. Washington was willfully toying with bankruptcy. The ratings agencies could not do their arithmetic. Millions of people were in the streets, protesting, demanding a rupture, unable or unwilling to pay debts they had contracted or that had been contracted in their name. Over the weekend of August 6th and 7th, as the world digested the downgrade of America's sovereign debt, heads of government, central bankers, and treasury officials interrupted their summer vacations for a frantic round of telephone conferences. But all that emerged were lame communiques, which did nothing to inspire confidence. On Monday, August 8th, rocked by bad news from both sides of the Atlantic, stock markets sold off sharply. President Obama was left to remark, "We now live in a global economy where everything is interconnected, and that means that when you have problems in Europe and in Spain and in Italy and in Greece, those problems wash over into our shores." In the general crisis of legitimacy in 2010 and 2011, there was no Archimedean point. There was no place to stand above the fray. Bringing this home was the point of the protesters getting in the face of government officials in Spain and Italy. They wanted to break through the invincible authority and distance that separated decision-makers from those their decisions impinged upon, to force them to come face-to-face with a different reality. And over the summer of 2011, a small band of U.S. activists determined to do the same at the hub of the world financial economy in New York. On August 19th, 2011, representatives of the New York Stock Exchange met with agents of the FBI for an unusual conference. Trawling the internet for suspicious activity, the FBI had got wind of an anarchist network dubbed Occupy Wall Street. Its aim was to spread the protest movement that had gained such scale in Europe to the United States. The occupation of Zuccotti Park, right next to Wall Street, was scheduled for September 17th. The U.S. media at first ignored the story. The first to cover it were Agence France-Presse and The Guardian. But within weeks, the tiny encampment that lodged itself within hailing distance of Wall Street would become headline news around the world. Given the scale of the social media storm it unleashed, it is important to put Occupy Wall Street in perspective. It was tiny compared with the gigantic anti-austerity mobilizations in Europe. The global Occupy demonstrations that took place on October 15, 2011, attracted perhaps as many as 1 million demonstrators in Spain, 200,000 to 400,000 in Rome, tens of thousands in Portugal. In New York, between 35,000 and 50,000 protesters marched. But the New York occupation had a symbolic significance far in excess of its modest scale. It articulated radical opposition at the very heart of U.S. capitalism. Imitation camps sprang up across the United States, in Philadelphia, Oakland, Boston, Seattle, Atlanta, L.A., Denver, Tucson, New Orleans, Salt Lake City, and many other cities. Further afield, there were notable solidarity camps in London, Seoul, Rome, Manila, Berlin, Mumbai, Amsterdam, Paris, and Hong Kong. Estimates vary, but protesters in at least 900 cities around the world staged sympathy demonstrations. Across the United States, wherever they sprouted, the Occupy camps could expect the watchful presence of the FBI and even U.S. counterterrorism authorities. But despite their tiny size and ramshackle appearance, the obvious and unsettling fact was that the anger of the radical minority was shared by a wide swath of U.S. public opinion. In October 2011, a poll conducted for the New York Times and CBS News found that almost half those questioned felt that the FBI's anarchist camp reflected the views of most Americans. Two-thirds thought wealth should be distributed more evenly, 9 out of 10 Democrats, two-thirds of independents, and even one-third of Republicans agreeing with that sentiment. But only 11% of Americans trusted their government to do the right thing. 84% disapproved of the Congress that had threatened to bring the U.S. federal government to its knees, and 74% thought their country was on the wrong track. Since January 2009, the Obama administration had been straining every muscle to put the lid on popular discontent. Rather than seeking to mobilize the indignation simmering in American society, it had found one technocratic fix after another. 2 years later, the result was a spectacular delegitimization from both the left and the right. Chapter 17. Doom Loop. On September 1st, 2011, Pedro Passos Coelho, Portugal's new prime minister, made his first visit to Berlin. His host, Chancellor Merkel, began the joint press conference by announcing how pleased she was to hear that the Troika had just submitted its first report on Portugal's structural adjustment program and had declared itself satisfied with the progress being made. She was delighted also to hear that Coelho saw no obstacle to incorporating a German-style debt break into Portugal's constitution. Then, in the question-and-answer session that followed, it seemed that Chancellor Merkel let the cat out of the bag. Asked about the question of parliamentary control over the European Financial Stability Facility, recently mandated by the German Constitutional Court, Merkel deadpanned, "We do live in a democracy, and we are pleased about that. It is a parliamentary democracy. That means that the budget is a key prerogative of Parliament. Thus we will find ways to organize parliamentary co-determination in such a way that it is nevertheless market-conforming, so that the appropriate signals appear in the markets. I hear from our budget specialists that they are conscious of this responsibility." Market-conforming co-determination. Was this what European democracy had been reduced to by the autumn of 2011? Was this the hidden agenda of the Troika programs imposed not only on the parliaments of Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, but on the Bundestag as well, to make them market-conforming? For many who joined the protests of 2011, Merkel's words confirmed their jaundiced view of the EU as little more than a container for the rule of the markets, or that new buzzword of the crisis, neoliberalism. Merkel did little to clarify the situation. On September 22nd, a few days ahead of the IMF meeting in Washington, she welcomed the first German Pope, Benedict XVI, to the Chancellery. Quizzed by curious journalists, Merkel volunteered that the European crisis had been at the heart of their conversation. "We spoke about the financial markets and the fact that politicians should have the power to make policy for the people and not be driven by the markets. This is a very, very big task in today's time of globalization." In their flailing generality, these statements are symptomatic of the depth of the crisis by the autumn of 2011. In the space of barely 3 weeks, the German Chancellor managed to tell the press that politicians should be responsible to markets, and to tell the Pope that politicians should make policy for the people regardless of those markets. Was it a contradiction, or was she implying some kind of synthesis? If so, was it a matter of finding the market-conforming mode of expression that would allow politicians to slyly exert their power, or, more ominously, a matter of hammering democracy into such conformity that no market ever need fear the policy Parliament might make? Did anyone in Berlin know? No surprise that Gregor Gysi, the sharp-tongued spokesman of Die Linke, should lash Merkel's handling of the Eurozone crisis as an engine of chaos and confusion. The very least one can deduce is that the optimistic dogma under which democracy and markets were seen as natural and necessary complements, the mantra of the aftermath of the Cold War, was dead. In its place, the crisis had put a more realistic awareness of the potential tension between the two. But this generalization too has its risks, particularly when it is assumed that it is financial markets, not politics, that force the tension. Certainly in the course of the Eurozone crisis, that had not been the case. The pressure the more fragile members of the Eurozone were under depended not on some inescapable clash of peoples and markets or global capitalism and democracy. It was dictated, first and foremost, by the willingness, or not, of the ECB to buy bonds. In the markets, many banks and traders were not just crying out for the EU to undertake a stabilization effort, but betting billions that it ultimately would. What delayed the stabilization and escalated the conflict between democracy and markets to an extraordinary pitch was the struggle among Germany, France, and the ECB over the future governance of the Eurozone, a question in which politics and economics were inseparably intertwined. Ironically, the result, as in 2010, was to escalate the crisis to the point that European affairs could no longer be safely left to the Europeans. The compromise of July 21st on a new Greek aid package was supposed to be flanked by a new round of bond buying by the ECB. Ireland and Portugal, at least, were judged to be making sufficient progress under their IMF-supervised programs. So on August 4th, 2011, the ECB let it be known that it was once again in the market for their bonds. Prices and yields promptly stabilized. This was the cheery backdrop to Coelho's visit to Berlin. But as far as Italy and Spain were concerned, Trichet did not want to let them off the hook so easily. The ECB needed further proof of conformity. To make the point, on August 5th, Trichet dispatched a confidential memo to Prime Ministers Zapatero and Berlusconi, spelling out what would be necessary for the protection of the ECB's bond purchases to be extended to them. In the case of Italy, weight was added to the missive by the signature of Mario Draghi, head of the Italian Central Bank and Trichet's anointed successor at the ECB. Neither Spain nor Italy had applied for a Troika program, but that did not stop the ECB from demanding huge cuts to government spending and increased taxation. In the Italian case, Trichet and Draghi called for the privatization of local public services, a proposal that had recently been decisively rejected in a nationwide referendum. The ECB also called for dramatic changes to labor market policy, infringing on rights of Italian and Spanish trade unions. Such changes were necessary, the ECB insisted, to cut unemployment and increase growth. It was a blatant attempt to shift the balance of social and political power by means of monetary policy, poorly disguised by the ECB's proviso that care should be taken to ensure that the social safety net remained intact. In case these unpopular measures encountered opposition, Trichet and Draghi suggested that the Italian government should invoke the decree powers of Article 77 of the Italian Constitution, which allowed executive action in cases of extraordinary need and urgency. Originally designed to counter the spectre of communist insurrection during the Cold War, Article 77 was a legal fig leaf that had been repeatedly invoked since the 1970s to cover emergency measures. Its overuse had been criticized by the Italian courts. If Berlusconi was worried about the legality of these proceedings, Trichet and Draghi advised that he should apply retrospectively for parliamentary sanction. Perhaps not surprisingly, legally minded members of Berlusconi's cabinet wondered whether it was their malodorous prime minister or Draghi and Trichet who posed the greater risk to the rule of law. The Spanish government chose to keep the ECB's letter secret. If it was to be humiliated, it preferred not to have the fact made public. As a sign of their compliance, Spain's two largest political parties agreed to amend the Spanish constitution, unchanged in 33 years, to provide for a balanced budget amendment. By contrast, Berlusconi accepted Trichet's terms, but under public protest. He would later say that the ECB's instructions made us look like an occupied government. But rather than embarrassing the ECB, the expostulation from Rome served only to enhance Trichet's reputation as a hardliner, which, in an ironic twist, freed him to act. On August 7th, the ECB began buying Italian and Spanish bonds under the Securities Markets Programme, SMP. This was enough to calm the markets and stave off the immediate risk of a disaster. But Berlusconi's government was evasive about the full scale of the austerity measures it was willing to adopt. The Italian economy was perched on the edge of a severe recession. Markets remained jumpy, and as everyone realized, things were going to get worse before they got better. The compromise on Greece, hammered out on the weekend of July 20th and 21st, had been inadequate from the start. Rather than achieving sustainability, Greece's consolidation program was falling consistently behind schedule. To escape insolvency, Greece needed a haircut far larger than that squeezed out of the bankers over the summer. Not 21%, but something closer to 50%. If this was not to cause panic, it would need to be framed by a solid Franco-German agreement on the future governance of the Eurozone. France was truly the last line of defense. If the crisis spread by way of Rome to Paris, the game would be up. Ominously, in the fall of 2011, as the ECB intervened to prop up Italian public debt, the spread of the 10-year French bonds relative to bunds nudged upward to 89 basis points. In reaction, Merkel and Sarkozy tightened their alliance. What Sarkozy desperately needed was a wall of money. With the ECB pursuing a strategy of tension, the only way to really calm markets would be to expand the EFSF or to agree to a wholesale mutualization of Eurozone public debt. It was Berlin's agonizingly slow acceptance of these basic facts that set the pace of the crisis. On September 29th, the Bundestag finally voted on the puny expansion of the EFSF bond market stabilization fund, agreed on July 21st. It was widely seen as a decisive vote for the future of Merkel's coalition. Though the EFSF was supported by the majority of the Bundestag, on the German right wing, the bond buying of the ECB had triggered a furious reaction. At the crucial ECB board meeting in August, Merkel's hard-line new appointee as head of the German Bundesbank, Jens Weidmann, once a star pupil of Axel Weber and Merkel's personal economic adviser, not only voted against bond buying, but made his opposition public. On September 9th, Jürgen Stark, the German member of the ECB board and the bank's chief economist, the man widely thought to be behind the ECB's interest rate hikes earlier in the year, resigned in protest. To stop the momentum of the conservative rebellion, Merkel needed to win the EFSF vote in the Bundestag, not with the votes of the pro-European SPD opposition, but on the basis of her own Kanzlermehrheit, with the votes of her coalition partners. In the event, on September 29th, Merkel got the votes, but by a painfully narrow margin. Out of the 330 members of the government coalition, only 315 voted for the motion, four more than the 311 needed. Merkel was on top, but she had little room for manoeuvre. In any case, as soon as the Bundestag had voted, it was clear that it had been overtaken by events. As everyone in the markets realized, the EFSF fund that had been agreed over the summer was too small. The Bundestag vote on September 29th was simply the occasion to start talking about how the fund might be leveraged, something that had been explicitly ruled out by Schäuble ahead of the vote. Unless the markets suddenly calmed, Merkel's government would soon be rolling the parliamentary dice again. In the summer, it had finally been acknowledged that any Greek debt restructuring would require a full-scale bailout of Greece's own banks. They held so much Greek public debt that their balance sheets would not survive the debt write-down. What the European governments were still struggling to accept was that the problem was far wider than that. The politics of extend and pretend might have the benefit of deflecting attention from the creditor banks to the bankrupt government borrowers. It was the citizens of the Troika-supervised countries who paid the price. But it also allowed European policymakers to avoid getting to grips with the underlying problems of financial stability. The assumption, presumably, was that given time, the banks would take care of themselves. But despite the fairy tale numbers produced by the European stress tests, it was clear that this was wishful thinking. In fact, Europe's banks were sliding back toward the cliff edge in the fall of 2011. They were struggling to cope with pressure from six directions at once. The legacy losses from 2007 to 2008 were still on their books. Their holdings of European sovereign debt were increasingly impaired. The troubles of the Eurozone economy were bad for new business. The new capital and liquidity requirements of Basel III required painful balance sheet adjustment. In their most profitable niche markets, in the United States, Europe, and Asia, the European banks faced fierce competition from the resurgent American and Asian banks. And in light of all this, wholesale money markets were increasingly leery about offering funding. A slow contraction of balance sheets was one thing. If funding markets shut down, Europe would face a repeat of 2008. Given that acute threat, it was not without risk to openly address the long-term issues of the sector. But if the problem of recapitalization was not squarely faced, how would the banks ever be made safe? In August 2011, as she established herself as managing director of the IMF, Christine Lagarde took up the baton that Strauss-Kahn had dropped when he was carted off to Rikers Island jail. Already in 2009, IMF analysts had highlighted the inadequacy of European bank recapitalization. Now, 2 years later, in light of the escalation of the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis, the IMF estimated that the minimum the European banks needed was $267 billion in new capital. It was a daunting challenge, but without it, all other crisis-fighting measures on the side of fiscal and monetary policy would lack a solid foundation. European political obfuscations were obscuring the basic lesson of 2008. Questions of macroeconomic policy and systemic stability could not be hygienically separated from the workings of megabanks, now more politely known as systemically important financial institutions. The banks, of course, defended what they took to be their own interests. Never one to shrink from alarmism where bank regulations were concerned, the Institute of International Finance estimated that Basel III, plus national regulations, would force banks worldwide to raise their capital by $1.3 trillion by 2015. It was a huge ask, and many banks might simply prefer to shrink their balance sheets, flattening the fragile recovery. At the meeting of the Financial Stability Board on September 23rd in Washington, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan counterattacked. He condemned the new capital rules and challenged Mark Carney, the chairman of the Bank of Canada and head of the SFB, so violently that Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs felt it necessary to personally intercede. Bizarrely, Diamond denounced the Basel III rules as anti-American, whereas, in fact, the pressure they placed on the Europeans was far more severe. Rather than raising capital like their American counterparts, Europe's main lenders were deleveraging en masse, cutting the size of their loan business. On the basis of plans published by the banks themselves, analysts predicted a contraction of between 480 billion and 2 trillion euros. From the point of view of the regulators, this was exactly what was intended. The banks needed to de-risk. But it wasn't only a matter of corporate strategy. What was driving the contraction as much as anything else was the collapse in demand for loans. That spelled trouble ahead for the Eurozone economy, and it threatened a vicious circle in which a widening depression forced banks to make ever larger provisions for a new wave of non-performing loans, further tightening pressure on their balance sheets. It was not the misery of youth unemployment in Spain and Greece that made the Eurozone crisis into an object of global concern. The world would wake up late to what would be dubbed the populist danger. In 2011, it was the prospect of European banking crisis that seized the attention of policymakers around the world. If the trillion-dollar balance sheets of the French, German, Swiss, Italian, and Spanish banks were shaking, then the City of London and Wall Street would not be safe. And, as in 2008, the influence ran both ways. If the withdrawal of funding from American sources put the European banks under excessive pressure, they would drastically curtail their business in the United States. As William Dudley of the New York Fed later explained to Congress, money market mutual funds, which were providing dollar funding to the European banks during the summer and fall of 2011, were pulling back. Other lenders, large asset managers, were also pulling back from European banks. And this was causing those banks to start to get out of their dollar book of business. This was going on at a pretty feverish pitch through the late fall and in through the early winter. The panic was spreading to the American banks themselves. In the fall of 2011, the premium on American bank credit default swaps began to rise, ominously. On the morning of September 16, 2011, Treasury Secretary Geithner flew to Warsaw to attend, for the first time, the monthly meeting of European finance ministers and central bankers. In his widely leaked remarks, he apparently began on a humble note. "Our politics are terrible, maybe worse than they are in many parts of Europe," he said. The debt ceiling battle had ended in Congress only 6 weeks earlier. "Given the damage we caused the world in the early stages of the financial crisis, and given the challenges we have, we are not in a particularly strong position to provide advice to all of you. So I come with humility." But he then went on to insist that the ongoing conflict between Europe's governments and the ECB was very damaging. Governments and the central banks have to take out the catastrophic risk from markets. Austria's outspoken finance minister, Maria Fechter, later commented that the American Treasury Secretary's tone had indeed been very dramatic. What Geithner proposed was standard American maximum force firefighting doctrine. "The firewall you build has to be perceived as larger than the scale of the problem. You can't succeed by shrinking the problem to fit your current level of financial commitments. It's more dangerous to escalate gradually and incrementally than with massive preemptive force." According to the Treasury's own estimates, the Eurozone needed a fund of at least 1 trillion euros, and preferably 1.5 trillion. Picking up an idea launched by Mark Carney of the Bank of Canada and Philip Hildebrand of the Swiss Central Bank, Geithner argued that the European Financial Stability Fund should be leveraged to give it sufficient firepower to act as a firewall. The EFSF could borrow against the capital invested in it by Europe's governments. It was a neat solution, but controversial in Europe, particularly in Germany, because as it increased the fund's firepower, it also increased the liability for losses. It was the Europeans who invited Geithner to Warsaw. But in the wake of the Wall Street crash of 2008 and the congressional budget crisis of July 2011, there was probably no moment in living memory in which Europe was less willing to listen to financial advice from America. Jean-Claude Juncker refused point-blank to discuss Geithner's bailout fund proposal with a non-member of the Eurozone. Geithner stalked out of the encounter, refusing comments to the press. As one New York analyst commented, "I'm not sure it's productive for Secretary Geithner to have gone to Poland, given the European resentment towards the US. I fear that it may cause Europeans to cut off their nose to spite their face." That trivializing diagnosis was telling in its own right. But the rebuff to the United States was undeniable. On Geithner's return, the New York Times ran an unflattering piece contrasting the reception he had received with the triumphalism of the 1990s, when Time magazine had hailed his mentors, Greenspan, Summers, and Rubin, as the Committee to Save the World. In September 2011, Sheila C. Bair, Geithner's long-time nemesis as the chair of the FDIC, commented that the Treasury's advice might have been more compelling if it had come jointly from the United States and China, a point that the Chinese would make at the next G20 meeting. As the leaders of world finance convened in Washington for the annual IMF meeting at the end of September 2011, the mood was grim. The world's financial institutions were staring into the abyss, they declared. From the sidelines, Larry Summers, recently retired from the White House, declared, "Now, when these problems have the potential to disrupt growth around the world, all nations have an obligation to insist that Europe find a viable way forward." The Europeans could not go on pretending that all that was at stake were matters of Eurozone governance. The G20 pre-meeting issued a communique stressing that, in the face of the ongoing Eurozone crisis, "We commit to take all necessary actions to preserve the stability of banking systems and financial markets as required." Geithner and his British counterpart George Osborne combined to demand an end to Europe's political crisis. The emphasis on politics was telling. Canada's finance minister expressed incredulity that the global gatherings had been talking about Greece since January 2010. Geithner warned of a cascading default, bank runs, and catastrophic risk if Europe failed to build a big enough firewall. Lagarde, from her new vantage point in Washington, insisted that there was still a path to recovery, but much narrower than before, and getting narrower. And yet a week after the IMF meeting, the EFSF plan that Merkel would squeeze through the Bundestag was undersized, and Finance Minister Schäuble publicly denied any plan to increase it by means of leverage. The Europeans, and the Germans in particular, still did not get it. In the first week of October, as if to demonstrate that the dark talk in Washington was not merely alarmism, a run began on the Franco-Belgian bank Dexia, one of the casualties of 2008 that was most exposed to peripheral Eurozone debt. Once again, the European Banking Authority had embarrassed itself. Over the summer, Dexia had passed the third European stress test with flying colours. A post-mortem revealed that the stress tests had failed to account adequately for losses resulting from a restructuring of Greek debt. Furthermore, they had ignored altogether the issue of liquidity. In 2008, it had been collateral calls that triggered the disaster at Lehman and AIG. In 2011, they did the same to Dexia. The bank had contracted a huge portfolio of interest rate swaps on which it now faced demands for tens of billions of euros in collateral. The Belgian and French governments were forced into an expensive bailout at the worst possible moment. Given the potential impact on French public debt, the governor of the Banque de France, Christian Noyer, was forced to deny claims that France's credit rating might be in jeopardy. Meanwhile, from the other side of the Atlantic came news of trouble at the high-profile brokerage firm MF Global. American regulators had ordered MF Global to boost its net capital to cover against the multi-billion-dollar position it had built in Irish, Spanish, Italian, and Portuguese sovereign bonds. Inverting the legendary big short position that speculators had built against mortgage-backed securities in 2007, MF Global had taken a big long in Eurozone sovereign debt. It was gambling that other investors were underrating the stability of the Eurozone and the value of peripheral bonds. As institutional investors like pension and insurance funds and banks offloaded their Eurozone securities, it was MF Global that bought them up. As had been true in the case of the Big Short, there was a race between market sentiment and the ability of the contrarian investor to stay liquid. In October 2011, time ran out on MF Global. The regulator's call for more capital triggered inquiries into its balance sheets and revealed that to tide it over, in the face of huge market pressure, it had been dipping into client funds. By the end of October, one of the most high-profile investors betting that the Eurozone did indeed have a future collapsed. It was a bitter irony that it was precisely as MF Global filed for protection that the Eurozone finally began to take steps toward a more decisive resolution of the crisis. On October 23rd, the European leaders held a gathering to sketch the outlines of yet another stabilization plan. It involved deep debt restructuring, new loans for Greece, an expansion of the EFSF, bank recapitalization. Finally, all the elements of a solution were on the table. Indeed, the issues were beginning to be monotonously familiar. That, however, did not mean that the way forward was obvious or politically easy. On October 26, Merkel addressed the Bundestag to tell them that the expansion of the EFSF they had voted to approve a month earlier had not been enough, and that the fund might, after all, need to be leveraged. On the promise that under all circumstances Germany's liability would remain capped at 211 billion euros, Merkel again got the majority she needed. With Germany at least formally on board, European leaders assembled for a second time in Brussels on the afternoon of October 26th to finalize the third rescue package for Greece. This time, PSI would be the cornerstone of the entire deal. The haircut would be deep. Banks and their shareholders would have to recognize tens of billions of euros in losses. Rumor had it that the Germans were pushing for 60%. The creditors, negotiating from offices in the basement of the EU's Justus Lipsius building, held out for less, and they were a powerful group. Despite the ongoing sell-off of peripheral bond assets, in 2011 all the major banks of France, Germany and Italy still held Greek bonds. So too did Greece's own banks, major insurance funds and American hedge funds. To shift this weighty coalition of financial interests, it took not only financial inducements, but also a forceful personal intervention by Merkel and Sarkozy. At 4:04 a.m., on the morning of October 27th, a deal on voluntary bond exchange at 50% was announced. The plan promised to reduce Greece's debt below 120% of GDP. To tide it over, Greece was to receive another 130 billion euros in funding, bringing the total in emergency loans it had received since 2010 to 240 billion euros, or more than 100% of Greek GDP. To contain the fallout from this momentous decision, all other euro area member states solemnly reaffirmed their inflexible determination to honour fully their own individual sovereign signature. The EFSF was to be boosted to close to 1.2 trillion euros by means of leverage or by using its resources not to make loans directly, but as an insurance fund to cover losses on private securities. And Europe's banks were expected to recapitalize to the tune of 106 billion euros, though it was left up to them how they raised the funds. At last, Europe had produced a package that at least in outline recognized the fundamentals of the problem. Debt reduction, recapitalization, and backstopping were the keys. The questions of who would pay and how exactly the EFSF would be equipped still had to be settled, but before those essential technical questions could be broached, Europe had to deal with the political fallout. By the end of October 2011, after 2 years of economic disaster and financial panic, the Greek political system was coming apart. Unemployment now stood at 19.7%, up from 8% in 2008. The public mood was ugly. Since the onset of the crisis, the Greek opposition, on both the left and right, had consistently refused to join with the government in facing the demand of the foreign creditors. The entire disastrous austerity program had been conducted on the strength of the majority that PASOK had won in October 2009. The party was paying the price. In the third week of October, giant demonstrations across Greece challenged the latest round of cuts. The strikes were unprecedentedly wide-ranging. Trash collectors, teachers, retired army officers, lawyers, and even judges walked off the job. A member of the Communist Party was killed in clashes with the police. On October 28th, the day of commemoration of national resistance, the venerable President of the Republic, Karolos Papoulias, himself a partisan veteran, was howled down by protesters in Thessaloniki. Seeking to regain the initiative, on the evening of October 31st, Prime Minister Papandreou convened a meeting of his party and announced that it was time to call the majority of the Greek people into action and to shame the opposition into supporting the measures dictated by the Troika. There would be a referendum, yes or no, on the EU's latest debt restructuring and austerity program. It was a reasonable political move on Papandreou's part, but did Greece still have the kind of freedom of manoeuvre a referendum implied? The complex deal that had been announced in the early hours of October 27th was the result of months of agonizing discussion between Paris and Berlin, Brussels, the ECB and the IIF, representing creditors from around the world. Merkel had twice whipped the Bundestag. The July 21st plan had been ratified by every parliament in Europe. Now, without prior warning, the Greek premier was adding a further democratic hurdle. Markets aside, how were the other parliaments to react? What if the Greek voters rejected the proposal? Merkel, at least, had been given some prior intimation of Papandreou's gamble. But October 31st was the first that Paris had heard of it, and Sarkozy was incandescent. The Greeks were putting the entire stabilization package in doubt, and France knew that it was no longer safe. On November 2nd, Papandreou was summoned to the G20 meeting in Cannes, not a forum to which Greece was normally invited, to explain himself. At a press conference in Cannes, Sarkozy and Merkel laid down the law. If there was to be a referendum, there could be only one question, in or out of the Eurozone. Our Greek friends must decide whether they want to continue the journey with us. We want them to stay inside the Euro, but they must obey the rules. Otherwise, they would receive not a single cent from French and German taxpayers. In fact, the majority of the Greek political class and Barroso as Commission President judged the proposition of a month-long referendum campaign far too risky. On November 3rd and 4th, in side meetings at Cannes, Merkel and Sarkozy manoeuvred with the Greek opposition and Papandreou's ambitious finance minister Evangelos Venizelos to abort the referendum proposal and end Papandreou's premiership. Papandreou was replaced by a safe technocratic pair of hands, Loukas Papademos. The new Greek prime minister was an American-trained economist and central banker, a former vice president at the ECB. But the real stuff of the Cannes meeting, once the Greeks were hammered into line, was the search for a fix for Italy. If the worst came to the worst, Greece could be let go. Italy had to be stabilized. In a preemptive move to restore confidence, the IMF had proposed an 80 billion euro precautionary program that would come with such tight financial provisions that it would rob Berlusconi of any wiggle room. Berlusconi refused the role assigned to him. The only public result that emerged from Cannes was an agreement by Rome to accept IMF monitoring on a voluntary basis, as a matter of pride and self-vindication, but not as the condition on a loan. Indeed, Berlusconi let it be known that he had rejected an offer of IMF money. Italy thus got the worst of all worlds. The stigma of having been considered for an IMF program and the duress of oversight without access to new money. This, at the time, appeared to be the dispiriting upshot of the Cannes conference. The removal of the Greek prime minister, deadlocked negotiations, no aid for Italy, and a further faux pas by Berlusconi. 3 years later, it emerged that something far more dramatic had transpired. Lagarde's Italian proposal was a sideshow. The real news was that Paris and Berlin were manoeuvring to unseat the Italian Prime Minister. As Geithner put it in transcripts compiled for his memoirs, "The Europeans actually approach us softly, indirectly, before the thing, the Cannes meeting, saying, 'We basically want you to join us in forcing Berlusconi out.' They wanted us to basically say that we wouldn't support IMF money or any further escalation for Italy if they needed it, if Berlusconi was Prime Minister." It was cool, interesting. Geithner could not hide his approval of the basic idea. "I really actually felt, I thought what Sarkozy and Merkel were doing was basically right, which is, this wasn't going to work. Germany, the German public, were not going to support, like, a bigger financial firewall, more money for Europe, if Berlusconi was presiding over that country." Unfortunately, a further page of Geithner's candid observations was redacted. In his memoirs, Geithner says that he informed the president of this surprising invitation from Europe, but concluded, "We couldn't get involved in a scheme like that. We can't have Berlusconi's blood on our hands," Geithner told the president. But whether the White House accepted the surprising invitation or not, Berlusconi's days in office were numbered. His government was disintegrating from within. The Northern League was refusing to cooperate in the changes to the pension system demanded by the rest of Europe and the IMF. Finance Minister Tremonti was pushing for Berlusconi to resign. Already in mid-October, Angela Merkel had made phone calls directly to the Italian president, Giorgio Napolitano, to explore alternatives. Napolitano, a long-time PCI apparatchik, Henry Kissinger's favourite Euro-communist, had agreed that it was his duty to verify the conditions of Italy's social and political forces. By November 12th, with his coalition crumbling, Berlusconi lost a vote of confidence in Parliament and resigned. What the condition of Italy's social and political forces apparently demanded was rule by technocrat. The man who recommended himself was Professor Mario Monti. Like the new Greek Prime Minister, he had a background as an academic economist with exposure to the United States. As European Commissioner for Internal Market and then for Competition between 1995 and 2004, he acquired the nickname the Italian Prussian. After leaving the Commission, Monti served as international advisor to Coca-Cola and Goldman Sachs and founded Bruegel, Europe's most influential think tank. In 2011, he was summoned from his position as president of Bocconi University to become Italy's prime minister. To make this elevation to the head of government possible, Monti, who held no elected office, received from Napolitano the honorary position of life senator. In mid-November, the governments of two Eurozone members were taken over by men without democratic credentials, whose main qualification was that they were undeniably market-conforming. Critics pounced on the web of connections that tied key Eurozone decision-makers to Goldman Sachs and its bond market dealings in Europe. It was surely more than coincidence that Monti, Draghi, and Ottmar Issing, Merkel's favourite economic adviser, had all worked for Goldman. But to describe this simply as a defeat of democracy at the hands of global markets would be misleading, to say the least. There have been many governments felled by market pressure. But Geithner was right. The driving force in the Eurozone in the fall of 2011 was political, not economic. Berlusconi had to go because otherwise there would be no agreement from the German public, at least as represented by Merkel's government, to a bigger European firewall. The gutting of Greek and Italian democracy in 2011 was the result of a toxic combination of massive financial integration with Berlin's dogged insistence on intergovernmentalism. The lack of overarching structures with which to compensate for the asymmetric effects of the crisis enforced conformity to Berlin's vision of financial probity, one state at a time. Around the Chancellery in Berlin, in the wake of the changes in Greece and Italy, they were not bemoaning the oppressive force of markets. Senior officials could be heard boasting, "We do regime change better than the Americans." But the twisted logic of the crisis was far from fully played out. Installing Prussians at the head of two of the most dangerously indebted Eurozone countries no doubt made Merkel and Schäuble more comfortable. But as far as the markets were concerned, the character of the national governments in Italy and Greece was a secondary concern. What the markets and the rest of the G20 were waiting for was the next step, a decisive move toward a higher level of European integration. What was needed was a decision on the EFSF, and that depended not on Greece or Italy, but on overcoming Germany's objections to a larger stabilization fund. No Eurozone member could risk a direct showdown with Berlin, and Merkel knew it. So it came as a nasty surprise for the German delegation at Cannes when at 9:30 in the evening on November 4th, Sarkozy called the heads of government back for a conference on the Italian question, and it was not the French president, but President Obama who was in the chair. As one member of the German delegation commented to the Financial Times, it was strange. It was a signal that Europe was not able to do that. It was a sign of weakness. It would have been closer to the truth to say that it was a sign of Germany's strength and stubbornness. Sarkozy ceded the chairmanship to Obama in the hope that America's weight and influence would be enough to overcome Germany's political and legal objections to the solution the Eurozone desperately needed. As Obama put it, "Our preference in the U.S. is that the ECB should act a bit like the Federal Reserve. In other words, the ECB should calm the markets by buying bonds." If that was vetoed by the Bundesbank because it blurred the line between fiscal and monetary policy, what Europe needed was a truly massive government-backed bond-buying fund with in excess of 1 trillion euros in effective purchasing power, ideally in excess of 1.5 trillion. Given the limitations of the existing EFSF, the Americans and the French proposed an improvisation that would involve topping up the fund with SDRs issued by the IMF and then leveraging the enlarged pot. It was a neat, technical fix, but the subterfuge was too obvious. The Bundesbank would not agree to a plan that transferred huge influence to the EFSF by way of the IMF, entities over which it had no direct influence. Even Obama's pressure was not enough. Merkel offered that if Italy agreed to be disciplined by the IMF, she could go back to the Bundestag to get authorization to approve an increase in the Eurozone Rescue Fund. But she could not agree to the leveraged SDR fix. Even if all 19 other members of the G20, backed by every financial authority in the world, insisted that this was the best way forward, if the Bundesbank was against it, Merkel would rather let markets rip. At the time, the G20 did no more than record the negative result of the meeting. A discreet veil was drawn over the details of the discussions. No one doubted where the obstacle lay. It was only several years later that investigative reporting established how close Merkel had come to a physical collapse under the pressure exerted on her by Obama and Sarkozy. On the verge of tears, she blurted out, "That is not fair. I cannot decide in lieu of the Bundesbank. Ich will mich nicht selbst umbringen. I do not want to kill myself. I'm not going to take such a big risk without getting anything from Italy." Behind closed doors, there was no more talk of globalization, democracy, and markets, the abstractions that Merkel had bandied about with the Pope. What defined the parameters of an acceptable solution to the Eurozone crisis was the constitution of the Federal Republic, the autonomy of its central bank, and the political interests of the German centre-right. If the Americans found this frustrating, Merkel expostulated, they had no one to blame but themselves. It was they who had created the embryo of the Bundesbank in 1948 as the founding institution of West Germany. At Cannes, in November 2011, it was as if the entire transatlantic settlement since World War II were being put in play. Merkel was not play-acting. She knew how narrow her coalition's majority was. If she had returned to Berlin with a Franco-American proposal, she might well have faced a major mutiny on the right and the need for early elections. Given the opinion polls at the time, that was not an attractive option for Merkel. With support for her FDP coalition partners collapsing, a German election at the end of 2011 might well have yielded a majority for Red-Green. That was not the outcome to the Eurozone crisis that Sarkozy wanted. Given the pressure that France was coming under, Paris was in no mood to take risks. The French and Americans backed off. The showdown in Cannes in November 2011 was an indication of how serious the stresses on Europe had become. But it left the Eurozone stuck on the German roadblock and divided over its future direction. At the ECB, which the hardline Bundesbankers had abandoned in protest, the German seat was taken by Jörg Asmussen, a market-orientated but pragmatic civil servant with social-democratic leanings, very much in the Ruben Summers-Orszag mode, one of the architects of German financial globalization under Germany's Red-Green coalition in the early 2000s. Having witnessed the workings of the ECB and the G20 up close, he commented on the cruel dilemma he faced. "Either you do what is right for Europe, and they crucify you in Germany, or you are the hero of the FAZ, the conservative Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung newspaper, and you ruin Europe." The tension could be felt even inside such a major financial actor as Deutsche Bank. Among the financial blogging community, a PowerPoint deck was circulating that showed Deutsche's Anglophone and London-based research department worrying that the Eurozone had reached a dangerous tipping point, from which only urgent action by the ECB could save it. Without such intervention, Europe might face a doom loop of public and private insolvency and illiquidity. As in Greece, bad sovereign debts would pull down the banks, or as in Ireland, failed banks would pull down the state's credit. Only the ECB could break this loop. It was the missing ingredient in all European crisis management efforts to date. Meanwhile, from Deutsche Bank's head office in Frankfurt, Der Spiegel quoted CEO Josef Ackermann towing the Bundesbank line. "If we start developing the ECB into a bank that performs completely different tasks beyond maintaining price stability," Deutsche's boss opined, "we will lose people's confidence." He was at odds with his own analysts and those of every other major bank in the Anglosphere, but in Germany it was Ackermann's line that was the mainstream. The chief economist of insurance giant Allianz advised strongly against unlimited purchases of government bonds. "If a country was unable to sort out its finances," he said, "we should let the markets speak." The chief economist of Commerzbank, Jörg Krämer, warned that if the virus of mistrust spreads to the ECB, it will have serious consequences. ECB bond purchases permanently transferred wealth from northern to southern Europe, without democratic legitimization and without the debt problems being solved. Meanwhile, even Germany was no longer immune to the virus of insecurity. On November 23, 2011, the Bund suffered a bond auction that was described by market watchers as a complete and utter disaster, with only 3.644 billion out of 6 billion euros worth of German 10-year bonds finding buyers. Some direction was clearly needed in the Eurozone, and it could only come from Berlin. The point was made with historic force by Poland's foreign minister, Radek Sikorski, an Oxford-educated former journalist. Speaking on November 28, 2011, choosing as his platform the German Council on Foreign Relations in Berlin, Sikorski demanded that Germany, read Merkel, step up and lead. If she did so, Poland